Hey everyone, John Wertheim here. It is this week's Sports Illustrated / Tennis Channel Tennis Podcast. Thanks for joining us. Our guest this week is Sonia Kenin, top 40 American 20-year-old, has already won one title this year in Hobart and is playing some very nice, feisty, steady tennis. Fun conversation. She was in Madrid. She had the misfortune of drawing Petra Kvitova, the defending champion, in the first round, so she had some time to kill. We'd been talking about doing this for a few weeks, so we made time. This is a fun conversation with a likable up-and-coming player. Here's from Madrid. Here's Sonia Kenin. Welcome. How are you?
I'm doing well. How are you?
Good, thanks. We're going to call you Sonia. Is that okay?
That's fine, of course.
We're going to get fine. That out of the way. I think I told you this in Indian Wells. Somebody wrote to me and they said, what do you think about the Kenin sisters, Sophia and Sonia? And I had to explain that it's one person with a nickname.
Yeah, there's just one person.
Where is that one person? Where are you right now?
Well, this one person is in Madrid right now, and I'm going to get ready for Rome and then playing Strasbourg and Paris. So kind of busy.
Wow. So you're basically playing every week through the French Open now.
Basically, yeah. Yeah. I think it's a good preparation for French.
And then will you come back for the grass or do you stay in Europe?
I'll come back home for the grass and then, just start my grass in Mallorca.
Oh, you'll play that Mallorca event before Wimbledon?
Yeah, Mallorca and then Eastbourne and then Wimbledon, of course.
You were telling me you don't have access to a grass court in Florida? You'll practice for the grass on a hard court?
Yeah, I don't have any access on a grass court in Florida because there's no grass. So I guess the best thing to do is just to practice on hard, like I've always been doing. So
don't slide. We're gonna try and get you onto Jack Nicklaus's court.
Where that would be awesome. That'd really be awesome.
So you had a rough draw in Madrid. We're talking on Tuesday, first match out of the gate. You know, sometimes you get nice draws, sometimes you get Petra Kvitova in round one. What's the next week like for you? I mean, you're an ocean away from home. How do you spend that next week?
Well, I mean, it's just practicing. You know, I'm trying to find practice with girls, you know, just, you know, getting used to the red clay and everything, getting ready for my next upcoming tournaments because, you know, I mean, yeah, it was a tough job playing Petra. You know, she's a great player, and I respect to her. And, I mean, hopefully I can do well in the next tournaments, and just looking forward to compete out there.
You are now top 40. I always say when you get that seeding at a major, when you're top 32, you are guaranteed your first two matches, you're not going to play anyone ranked higher than you are, which, you know, it's a night. You're suddenly in the third round. Is that something that players think about? I mean, are you looking at that seeding list for the French Open, or is that not in your thinking?
I mean, yeah, that would be great to be seeded there, and I'm not really going to try to focus on that. You know, I don't want to put extra pressure on myself, but of course, there's big pluses when you're seeded on a Grand Slam. You know, you always get a court on site. You know, like you said, you know, you're not going to play a seeded player until like the third round. So that's always, you know, helpful and makes things way easier. But, you know, it's, you know, anyone can beat anyone on any given day there. So, you know, it's just however you prepare yourself and how mentally and emotionally ready, how you're ready. And then it actually doesn't really matter if you're seeded or not, but obviously seeded is big pluses.
I was looking for your contact info on my phone and I was going through emails and I saw from 2017, you know, junior champion Kenin to play Maria Sharapova. And I'm thinking you have made a very, very smooth and fast transition from the juniors to top 40.
Transition has been good. I'm happy to make this transition. And as you said, you know, against playing Maria, my idol, was really amazing. And it was an experience, you know, that I'll never forget. And, you know, still trying to get up there, climbing the rankings. And, yeah, just excited what's to come for me.
You're talking about that match at the Open against Sharapova 2 years ago.
Yes.
What's that experience like for you? I mean, we have that all the time where players get a big match under the bright lights and they get to play a star on Arthur Ashe. And then oftentimes, you know, we don't hear much from them again for a while. With you, that wasn't the case. What did you take away from that match with Maria?
I mean, the experience, you know, I just saw, if you work hard, you're going to play in that amazing stadium, you know, under the lights in New York City, you know, I mean, best time, you know, night session, last match, you know, I couldn't ask for anything better. And, yeah, I mean, after that match, you know, I got experience. I started getting used to playing in front of bigger crowds, and, yeah, just been practicing, trying, working hard every day, and it's proving that I'm able to compete with these girls, and I've proven it to myself and people around me. Obviously, they can see this, and I'm a competitor out there, and you know, it's tough to play against me.
How close were you to going to college that night? Had you decided to play pro, or were you still thinking about college tennis at that point?
I mean, at that point, after Maria, for sure, I was going to go professional. I mean, that really wasn't the question there. I knew that I was going to go professional, so I was really happy. And third round at US Open, it made the decision much easier. So very happy to have done that.
You talk about your competitiveness and your fight. And if you ask other players about you, that's the first thing she said. You know, she's not the biggest player out there, but she competes really well. Where do you suppose you got that?
I guess it's just character, I guess. You know, I have a little bit of Russian inside me, and, you know, usually they're feisty and not exciting, and, you know, they're not going to give up. And, yeah, I got that inside me. And, you know, I've always, speaking of Russian, you know, I've looked up to Maria Sharapova, and I've always watched her matches, and I've seen how she's, you know, fighting and never gives up. And, you know, I wanted to, you know, I knew that this is, you know, this is perfect and this is what I need. And, yeah, that's how I got it.
Have you talked to her much? Have you? I mean, I'm looking at your backgrounds. There's some similarities. There's some overlap. You're giving her a few inches in height. I'm not sure you guys necessarily are looking eye to eye when you're standing at the net. But apart from that, you guys have a lot in common. Have you spoken to her?
I mean, I just said good match, and then, you know, she said, well, thank you, you played well. And then at the locker room, I wished her good luck. She said, thank you, good luck in your future. And yeah, that's the last time we've spoken, because after that, you know, we haven't talked.
Tell us about your coaching situation. We've seen your father come out for on-court coaching during matches, but I know you were with Rick Macy for a while. Tell us a bit about your coaching and your influences.
I mean, my dad is my main coach, and as you saw, he's coming out on court, always coaching me. You know, always helps me, is always there for me, and you know, I'm happy with my coaching since he's my coach, and I think it's working perfectly. You know, we're finding a balance between a coach or a father and daughter, so I think we're doing a really good job with this. And I know he knows exactly what he's talking about, and he helps me, and he knows me better than anyone, so he would obviously know exactly what to tell me, how to help me if I'm down. He knows the right words to say just to, you know, get me up. And yeah, and then after that, I just started playing better. So yeah, it's working perfectly.
Sounds like you really trust him.
Yeah, for sure.
Does he have a tennis background, or is it more a situation where he just knows how to motivate you? He knows how to convey a message. He knows sort of what buttons to push.
Just that, as you said, he knows exactly what he's talking about. He knows exactly what to say at the right moments, at the right times, and you know, it's been helping me, and it's, yeah, I'm just really happy with it. And yeah, I think it's just great that we were able to, you know, do this together. And I think it's really important.
You worked with, you spent time at Balotelli's too, right?
That was a while ago. Yeah. When I was little, I trained there a little bit. Don't remember much there, but I just remember I was there a little bit.
So mostly at Macy's, or where were you, where would you say you're based?
Well, I mean, I was, like, as you said, was Nick there a little bit, and then Macy, I was with Macy also for some time, and he helped me, working on my, on my shots, you know, because he's really good with little kids, and he helps me. And then after that, it's just, you know, I knew I needed, you know, next level if I wanted to become professional. And then, you know, me and my dad started trying to find places to go and train and everything, but we've always been working together and doing it together. So, yeah, I mean, as you know, like on the road and stuff, you're usually hitting with like these girls and everything. You're not, you know, so it's just, I think it's just it's just a matter of just believing in yourself and knowing that if this is what you're doing, you're able to do it.
How do you think you're handling the public aspect of the job? I mean, I feel like people talk about the transition from juniors to the pros, and it's a lot about serves are coming faster and getting used to the travel, but being in public, being, you know, a celebrity in a lot of cases is a big adjustment that players sometimes handle better than others. How do you think you're handling being a public figure now?
I think I'm doing well with it. You know, I love when the fans cheer me, help me during the matches. And, you know, I love after the matches just to give autographs, take pictures, you know, makes them feel good and makes me feel good, you know, just to show them that I really appreciate their support. And, yeah, I think I'm doing a good job, you know, because making the transition from juniors to pros is not always easy. You know, like you said, you know, playing on the level, returning serves or playing on this fast level. So I think I've made a really good transition, and I've always known that I can do it, and that's why, you know, that's why I am where I am, and I'm hoping to get higher.
You seem very comfortable in public. You seem very comfortable on social media. I imagine that's sort of one less thing to deal with. I mean, I imagine having the kind of personality that doesn't mind posing for photos or doing the media or having yourself get recognized in an airport. I imagine that makes the job significantly easier.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I like social media, and I think it's fun, and you get to show who you are. You know, you show different sides of you, not only just the tennis. And yeah, I use social media, as you know, and yeah, just happy to share it with my fans.
Who's the best tennis follow besides yourself?
You mean on social media?
Yeah. Who do you follow on Twitter who you'd recommend other people? Sorry, who?
Jeannie Bouchard.
Yeah, jeez. She doesn't need any more followers. Who's someone that's a sleeper? Who's someone that people might not know about who you enjoy following?
Well, I actually follow people who people know, so I'm not really following people who others are, you know, that people don't know. But I like to follow celebrities. You know, different just stores, you know, just stuff like this, you know, some of my friends.
You want to give, I'll give you my favorite. Do you follow Belinda Bencic?
I followed her a few times and she never followed me back.
Oh man.
So yeah, she never followed me back. So I guess, still waiting, I guess, for that follower, you know.
Belinda Bencic, you've just been called out. She's very funny because she goes after her trolls and all these dirtbags who lose money with sports gambling that send her mean messages. She goes after. I have to ask you, you've seen it 1,000 times. I bet you've been asked about it 1,000 times. But the Andy Roddick video that the Tennis Channel interview when you were 7 years old. Do you remember that at the time? I mean, did you know that before people dusted that off and started passing that around?
I remember that video very well, and it's such a funny video. I love it, and I keep watching it over and over since I just saw it on, not just now, but I saw it a few months ago, and Tennis Channel posted, and I posted on my social media. I mean, it's just such a funny video of me, and it was Murphy there, you know, talking about Andy Roddick. You know, I kind of had like an attitude over there. It's funny, you know, just during the interview, you know, I was, you can tell, like, we've got a little Russian side over there. Got that sassiness, knowing that I can, you know, Murphy was asking, can you return his serve? I'm like, of course I can return his serve. So, yeah, I was pretty confident. So that's good.
You recognize that girl?
I recognize, yeah, for sure.
What do you said it twice now. What do you mean by your Russian side? Talk a little more about that.
I guess just feisty and very confident, you know, just knows exactly what I'm talking about there in that video. And no matter, you know, it's crazy, you know, Andy Roddick serve, I knew I'm going to return it. And yeah, as I said in the video, we wanted to have the same racket like Andy Roddick. So, yeah.
You're 7 years old and you have a Babolat racket. Why shouldn't you be able to return 140 mile an hour serve?
Exactly. That's what I thought. Yeah.
But that's the same confidence you're bringing on, you know, you're 20 years old and we still see expressions of that same confidence, don't we?
Yes. I like to keep it going and show my confidence when I'm playing and on court and off court.
You are top 40 now. It will be a successful year if at the end of the year you are blank. I mean, how do you define success at this point?
I just think, you know, it's just a matter of just playing well. Of course, being healthy is number one. So, and after that, it's just playing well, you know, just having great matches, you know, just getting more experience. And I think the rankings will come, you know, if I put in the hard work as I'm doing, it will come. And yeah, I don't want to really set a specific goal, just enough with extra pressure myself. But I believe I can get there and I'll get there.
Can you lose a match and leave the court happy?
Never.
You don't do the I played well, she was too good today. Whether it's Petra Kvitova or a tournament final. I mean, if you're playing there to win. I mean, if you come to the net and shake hands and you don't have the sixes and sevens by your name, it's not a good day at the office.
I mean, I'm never happy when I lose. Doesn't matter if she plays well or, you know, I played bad, but of course, I mean, if she played well and I played well and I lost, and, you know, I guess good job for her, you know, but still, it's not a good day at the office. It never is when I lose. And yeah, I don't like to, that's part of the Russian that I was talking, telling you about, you know, they don't like to lose. They want to win. And yeah, and winning is the most important thing. So
how long does it take you to calm down and sort of, you're upset when you're upset when you lose, or you're on a high when you win? How long does it take you to sort of come back to a regular band?
Well, I guess it depends, you know, the type of match. But I mean, if it was a really close match and I lost it, you know, like 1-2 points, you know, it's gonna take maybe like a day or so. And if I win, you know, like at US Open when I won those last year when I played against Sakari, I won that match, you know, I don't even remember going to sleep. I was like so happy that I won. And, you know, I knew I was playing Pliskova next match, third round, you know, I was just so happy and filled with emotions, you know, to have won. And of course, in the first match at US Open last year, when I had like two match points down and I won right. that match. And yeah, it was pretty dramatic, but I was just so happy to get through. And after that match, I did not go to sleep for sure because I saved two match points and It was a very dramatic match. So,
you're being serious. You stayed up the whole night.
I mean, I tried to go to sleep, but I just couldn't. You know, I was like, how did I win this match? You know, I was just surprised and everything. You know.
You are in Madrid. We're recording this on Tuesday. You're trying to find practice partners. You've got a gym you have access to. Do you have any time to walk around and go to the museum and go to the Prado and explore the city?
Well, we were planning to go to the museum tomorrow, but we have went a few times to the Plaza Mayor and just walk around the city, and it's so beautiful here and people are so nice. And yeah, I really love Madrid.
And you get Rome next.
Rome, yes, that's another special place that I really like.
And then you get Paris in 2.5 weeks.
Strasbourg, then Paris, but yeah.
You have Strasbourg in between. That's right. Any thoughts to playing the week before a slam? You don't mind that?
No, I don't mind that. I think it's always good practice to play before a slam, and you know, I think it's just good for matches and just for your confidence. And you know, hopefully I can do well and just come into Paris with more confidence would be really good.
But then you don't get those extra few days to explore Paris. We
always explore Paris after.
See?
I always find time to explore Paris.
I love that you were 20 years old and you were exploring these cities and not just spending time at the courts and in the lounge. More players should do that. This was great. You were. It's always a pleasure. I know we talked in Indian Wells. I'm glad we were able to do this. Here's what I want to do for you. We're going to get Belinda Bencic to give you a follow. And we are going to try and get you on a real grass court. You shouldn't be practicing for Wimbledon on a hard court.
Okay. Thank you so much. And if you would be able to do that, it would be a big lifesaver for me.
You know where to find me. We don't pay our guests, but we try to help them out in other ways. Go explore Madrid. You still have 5 hours of daylight. I don't want to keep you anymore.
Thank you so much for having me. It was fun.
Likewise. Take care. Good luck.
Take care. Thank you.
Thanks. All right. Thanks to Sonia for the conversation. Good perspective. Jamie, you listened to that conversation. What'd you make of our new friend? We can call her by her nickname. We don't have to use Sophia. She gave us the Sonia pass. What do you think of Sonia Cannon?
Sonia's great. Very feisty. Or, you know, she's...
That's her word.
That's her word. Exactly. You know, good to hear that she does, you know, she kind of realizes her place in the game. I think she understands her a little bit of her background and her heritage and how that may affect her, be it the way she plays on the court or be it Maria Sharapova comparisons, anything like that. So I thought she was good.
I thought there was some insight to tennis in a lot of ways, sometimes inadvertently. I mean, I like to think the part about people say, well, why do they let their parents coach them? The coaching has no background. And you heard what she said. Like, he understands me like no one else does. I thought the Maria Sharapova stuff was interesting. I mean, I think in any other conventional line of work, she says, Maria Sharapova is the player I idolize. They both have this Russian heritage.
Right.
There are a lot of similarities, a lot of overlap in the story. They came to Florida at, I think, almost exactly the same age. What's your interaction with Maria Sharapova? She said, good match at the net. That's not to disparage Maria Sharapova. I think it just was interesting in so far as it shows how individual and how brutal tennis is as this individual sport, as this combat sport. I mean, if there were another young up-and-comer in the Sports Illustrated newsroom who was from New Jersey and played college soccer and had an interest in tennis, you might make a point of saying, hey, we should have lunch sometime let me mentor you. Doesn't sound like there's a lot of mentorship going on.
Yeah, but to be fair...
it's a different workplace.
Yeah, exactly. I think, you know, I get it, but maybe the time just hasn't come yet for something like that, but... You know, like I said, she recognizes her place, which is good. And she's really upset that Belinda Ventures didn't follow her back.
Yeah, I know. didn't think the conversation would go there. I also did not think that Jeannie Bouchard would be the person everyone must be following on social media. But
she's a social media star.
I was going to say, Jeannie Bouchard's followers, tallies speak for themselves. I also think Sonia Cannon's an interesting case in that... she's obviously younger than the Sloane Stephens, Madison Keys, Coco cluster, and she's a little bit older than the Coco Gauff.
Mm. Right.
Whitney Osigwe. I mean, she's sort of in between generations.
There's
a little bit.
There's not a lot of 20-year-olds that we've discussed.
Exactly.
Yeah. And 37 she's up to, which is
37 is
damn good.
And she's not defending a whole lot. She she won Hobart and final in Acapulco, and then she played the opponent whose name I'm currently brain freezing on, who she lost to in Acapulco. She played first round match in Indian Wells and beat her, which I thought said something. Let's talk a little broader tennis. I mean, last week's discussion with Renee Stubbs, and in full candor, Renee lives in New York now. I thought it would be important to bring her in. I avoided Justin Gimelstob situation for a few reasons. One of them was the fact that it was a fluid situation. I thought it would be dated, and in fact was. He resigned from his board position and Tennis Channel the day after we recorded. Also thought it was important that deep in tennis circles, this has been a big talking point, but there is a sport going on and there have been competitive matches being played and tournaments being won and lost. And we're 3 weeks out of a major. I thought it was important to have some focus on tennis. But I also don't want to give short shrift to what I think has been a pretty convulsive few weeks for the sport. I'm sort of curious, Jamie, from where you sit, if, you have overarching thoughts on this Gimelstob situation.
Well, I thought that our colleague, Michael McCann, always does a nice job of diving into legal issues within sports. But I thought this was a good use of him. As you said, someone who's maybe not so familiar with tennis, but you were given some factual background. And then he kind of went off on how sort of a different angle. It's not all about what Gimelstob can do or should do, but what the ATP and the ATP board should do to try and help restore credibility. So I think anyone who hasn't read through it should read it. But I think the biggest thing is just about transparency. And I think he mentioned something about disclosure of conflicts.
Right.
So I think that's important for me. We talk about a lot of players and athletes and figures who have gone through legal things. I mean, we just recently talked about Tiger Woods and things that he went through in the public eye. And so there are many cases, and I don't think, like, I think everyone should be given the opportunity to redeem themselves in some way. But figuring that out in this particular situation is tough given the sort of state of tennis generally.
Yeah, I mean, I think I would encourage everyone, we can link it, I would encourage everyone to read Mike's column, because he came to this not just with a fresh set of eyes, but also with a lot of knowledge about how other sports operate. Mm-hmm. And reading between the lines, I think he had the same conclusion that a lot of people have, which is that this is just nuts. And this is not how other sports operate. And these conflicts are beyond the pale. And I think at tennis, we get a little, you know, it gets very inside baseball very quickly. And I think we get desensitized. And I think tennis's structure, where you have these tours that are basically comprised of tournaments and players, of labor and management, that is very different from conventional sports. But I thought it was really instructive to give this fact pattern to someone who could approach it with a fresh perspective, but also an informed perspective about how other sports operate. And reading between the lines, you sort of see someone who's a bit gobsmacked, who's a bit dumbfounded that this was allowed to exist. Somebody facing felony charges not only didn't have to resign, but was able to make the kind of policy that pushed out essentially the acting CEO, you know, the person who was the CEO. Somebody who's on a board is getting seven-figure contracts from the same organization. When people say, boy, tennis is a wacky world, this was an example of that. So anyway, I mean, I do hope that now that this seems to have died down, I do hope tennis can use this. And this, again, I think I wrote this in the piece. This might be too optimistic. I do hope tennis can really use this as an opportunity to examine itself and not just ask it questions, not just have the soul searching, but really make some material changes, really institute some policy here that prevents this kind of situation again. Because this was really, it wasn't good for the sport. It wasn't good for building trust and credibility. It wasn't good for the brand of tennis. But I also think it's just really anathema to growth. I mean, how does a sport grow itself when you have board members getting contracts from the organization they're supposed to represent? I mean, I just think you stand back and you, as Mike did, you say this fact pattern is just, A, it's nuts. B, it's not ethical. And C, and maybe above all, it is the enemy of growth. And this is something tennis can't afford, especially at this critical point.
So you think it's enough, it's big enough, impactful enough to sort of untangle the very tangled web that tennis has?
I don't know if I would go that far.
I don't think that...
That is cleaning the Aegean state. I mean, that's a big task. But I do think just some basic policy, and maybe we can grow from there, and maybe the ITF comes
enough
next.
Enough to spur a little bit of change and get the conversation going.
Exactly. And to just have some sort of basics. When this comes up again and executives are facing felony charges, there's a line in the document that you can go to say, here's why you need to take a leave of absence, and we are not judging you, and you have every chance for exoneration, and we respect the legal system. You will be given every presumption, but you ain't sitting in on board meetings and essentially seeing to it that executives you don't like no longer have jobs. That we're not going to stand for. So we'll see. You know what? I'll give you three topics that have been lost in all of this chatter, or at least semi-obscured.
All right.
One of them is just the strange clay season so far of Rafa Nadal. I mean, we are talking on Tuesday. He's yet to play his first match in Madrid. I was in touch with the camp yesterday, who basically said stomach problems, but he's ready to go. This has been a very distressing start to the clay court season for our 11-time French Open champion.
As Renee Stubbs
said last
week.
We talked about it last week.
Yeah. She said that on one hand, would not be surprised if he went into the French Open and won once again, which I agree with. But yes, it's a little, I think he's someone who needs to find his footing a little bit, especially heading in. And I think I said this, a few months back. He's someone who has kind of been a little disappointing this season. And it hasn't necessarily been always because of the results, but his body just hasn't been able to keep up with things as normal, which has prevented him from playing or has given him some early losses here and there. So you do worry about it a little bit, but I think if there's any place where he can kind of beat the odds, it's going to be in Paris. So this week will definitely be a really big a big time for him to either go either way on this.
I can't believe we're having this kind of discussion about Rafa Nadal on clay.
I think the other side of it, though, is that players like Dominic Thiem are rising as he has steadied and plateaued a little bit. So I think that's sort of pushing the conversation to say, all right, well, not only is Rafa not playing great, but there's someone who is making a really strong case for coming in and taking that crown in Paris. So
yeah, and I think this is something instructive, bigger picture about tennis, that we all love Federer, Nadal, Djokovic. They are titans of the sport. We can't say enough nice things about them. They were not going to play forever. And it's going to be a period of adjustment when they're not there, when you have these draws. There will be some ratings declines. There might be some attendance declines. It's going to take a while for tennis to adjust. But like you say, there's still going to be players that emerge. They're still going to give away the trophy. There's still going to be finalists and titleists. And it may take a while, but we shouldn't lose sight of the fact that it's not like they're going to stop holding these tournaments. So this, in a way, I think, is a bit of a snapshot. And yeah, if Nadal is rolling through clay, it might feels more familiar. It probably is better for TV and exposure, certainly in the short term. But Dominic Thiem's winning trophies and Tsitsipas is winning trophies. Let's segue. You know what also has not gotten its due in the past few weeks is Greek tennis. We keep hearing about the Greek freak. Milwaukee Bucks up 3-1. I'll have you know. I don't know if you saw it. Did you happen to catch Magic Johnson's tweet, by the way?
About Giannis?
So Magic Johnson, who leaves the Lakers in part because he wants to have the freedom to say nice things about other players and the freedom to tweet, wrote, I should find it and quote it verbatim, but last night it came across and it was something to the effect of Giannis, also known as the Greek Freak, scored a team-high 39 points as the Milwaukee Bucks took a 3-1 lead over the Boston Celtics. And you want to say
he will be dominating that NBA regular season and playoffs for many years to come.
Gee, thanks.
got the first part pretty correct.
No, but I think Twitter had a good laugh at the fact that here's a man who leaves his executive position citing his desire to tweet. And when he does tweet, he's basically taking the nut graphs of the Associated Press story.
He's showing the whole league why he is such a special player.
Yeah, I heard someone said, gee, great insight, Captain Obvious. Is Steph Curry any good, too? You hearing anything about him? But anyway, that was a digression to say that Greek tennis, God bless Greeks in the NBA, but Greek tennis, too. Maria Sakkari won Rabat. Tsitsipas won in Estoril. Nice. Very nice little sort of sub-story in tennis.
Yeah, and his second title of the year.
Yeah, exactly. This is a and this is after getting to the semis of the Australian Open with a takedown of Roger Federer.
There's got to be something in Athens we can trace back to this time and these players.
You know, everyone says, oh, it's what are they putting in the water? My takeaway from this is it doesn't take you only need two players. Very small sample size.
Right,
you need
right.
two good players, and all of a sudden you have a dynasty. It's sort of, you know, God bless Roger Stan and Martina Hingis, but three players does not a dynasty make. But Greek tennis is all of a sudden very well positioned.
Giannis included.
Yeah, Giannis. Oh, I see. No, you're right. It's like what we were talking about with
Canadians.
Canadians.
Exactly.
I'm looking at the doubles draw from Madrid.
Yes, this
and,
is.
I
mentioned this to you.
I'm telling you, I think this is another nice little sub story.
If these matches all happen one day over the course of a weekend, I'd be there for that double.
You'd
draw.
Go see that, right?
Oh my goodness, that's great!
Del Potro
awesome.
And Nishikori.
Yeah, good and to see Delpo back.
Yeah, good to see Delpo. We'll see how he fares in singles. Different draw, but Dimitrov and Khachanov, two players who are having very rough goes of it in singles. Just
brothers.
One there. Yeah, exactly. Be nice to see if this carried over. Kyrgios and Bernard Tomic. It'd be nice to see if this
team
carried
and
over.
Team
and Schwartzman.
Yeah.
Someone said we should
I'm
make these doubles teams with having the highest height differential possible. So Kyrgios Del Potro is a good one. But
Del Potro Schwartzman.
Yeah, Del Potro Schwartzman as well. That's Argentina for you. I larger point here though. Again, I think that the tennis world, certainly my Twitter silo, went very far and very deep down this ATP board, Justin Gimelstab rabbit hole. No question, it highlighted some disturbing flaws in the system and some real defects that need to be addressed. But I do think it probably took a bit too much away from the on-court action. Here we are starting our second major of the year in less than 3 weeks. We have players from unlikely countries. We have great doubles draws. We have Patrick Vinova vying for the number one ranking. There are a lot of nice stories in this sport, and I hope we can get back to talking about them, but at the same time, actually learning something and making some real material adjustments, because this ATP board situation was ugly, ugly stuff, and it's sort of the whispers. A lot of us have been banging this conflict of interest drum for a long time. This was a pretty vivid illustration of why this really needs to be addressed and policed. So
yeah, I think as we turn the corner into the end of the month, when we start to really get into the bulk of tennis in the summer, where everything's really crammed up in those few weeks, it's probably a good time for a major to come and, as you say, to focus on the tennis. But it will also, I think there's always a bigger than the court, off the court story that we are discussing leading into a major, and this will probably end up being it heading into the French. So it'll be interesting on both sides to talk some tennis, but then I'm sure the players will probably get asked about it as well.
And Serena was at the Met Gala.
Looking great.
Just wanted to get that out. All right, this is, that'll do it for this week.
Maria Sharapova was also at the Met Gala.
I did not know that.
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
Who was she wearing?
I know this. Versace?
All right.
I don't know. She was wearing, it was black and red. She had red lipstick, cat eye.
Oh,
very non-Maria.
This is the kind of stuff that I just goes over my head. All right. So thanks to...
Givenchy.
Givenchy. Oh, that's different from Versace.
It is.
All right. Thanks to Jamie. Thanks to Sonia Kennan. Fun conversation with an up-and-coming player. We'll have another guest next week. Thanks, everyone, for listening. Keep the guest suggestions coming. And have a good week.